welcome to Shattering Mess. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us at any time over the next 2 hours, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. This program is for those of you who are open to the realization that you have been lied to in every possible way by anyone speaking on behalf of religion, every politician, everyone involved in the military, most of those people involved in the justice system, and essentially everyone in the media, even in academia. Given the opportunity to tell the truth, they all prefer their lie. And it is those lies that have swirled around society to the point that most people don't even have the ability to recognize the truth, accept the truth, or even use evidence and reason as a means to define the truth. We really live in a mystical time of overall stupidity, is probably the best way to say it. It was highlighted a couple of days ago when there was a moment of silence for the victims in Paris, and the victims in Paris were attacked by fundamentalist Muslims. And they all screamed Allahu Akbar, saying that they were doing this in service to their God. Allahu Akbar is not a random saying. It is a confession. There is only one Allah, that is the wannabe God of Islam. And Allahu Akbar suggests, in fact, indicates that Allah wants to be seen as the oldest, the biggest, the greatest of any potential deity. And since his name is not Yahweh, and Yahweh actually proves that he is God and said any God by, or anyone claiming to be God by any other name is a false God, there's only one deity that I am aware of who routinely wants to be seen as greater, bigger, older than Yahweh. And that's HaSatan, Satan, the adversary, whom Allah is modeled after. For those who do not know that Allahu Akbar does not mean God is great. And, you know, the Arabic word for God is not Allah. It's Il or Ilah from the Hebrew El and Eloah. So the fact of the matter is that Allahu Akbar, when the media says it means God is great, they're lying to you. And they know it, by the way. The Quran itself defines the fact that Allah is one of several names for the Islamic wannabe deity, along with Ar-Rahman and the Lord, but that Il is the Arabic word for God. It's clear. It's not even disputable. But political correctness doesn't allow anyone to say it because they want to demean all religions with the Islamic terrorism brush. But, Scott, are you aware of the first time Allahu Akbar was uttered? What the circumstances were? Who ordered the shout before and was it a terrorist act?
I don't know. I assume it was Muhammad, and I assume that he was doing what he does. So I assume it was during he was probably raiding a village of farmers or something.
Yeah, that has to be true. Islam is based entirely on the life and words of Muhammad. That's all there is. There's nothing more to Islam beyond Muhammad's words and deeds. Although, you know, to his shame, Muhammad did a fair amount of plagiarizing. And so he has twisted portrayals of other religions and other testimony woven into the fabric of his absolutely repulsive Quran. But the story of Allahu Akbar is undeniable. Every Muslim knows it. They know that Muhammad was the first to use it. It was used in a terrorist context. Muhammad had kicked the Jews, three tribes of Jews. They represented About three quarters of the population of Yathrib today is Medina, out of their town. He had enslaved the children. He had raped the women. He had murdered the men. But the first tribe that he dealt with, he wasn't quite as ruthless. It was kind of like Hitler during World War II. Hitler really didn't become murderous with Jews until a Muslim, the Grand Ayatollah, not the Ayatollah, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, encouraged him to do so. And so he banished the first tribe, just wanted to steal the property, one of them out of his hair, because they knew that that he had created his Quran in large part by twisting the Bible verses, the Talmud verses that they had sold to him. And he then, after the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, where Muhammad was shamed into capitulating on his desire to wipe out his hometown. And his raiders came back, and they were, they were despondent. They were looking forward to raping women. They were looking forward to killing men. They were looking forward to stealing property. They were the first Muslims, of course. And Muhammad needed easy prey. So he came upon the town of Qabar. Kirk, what do you think happened at Qabar that prompted Allahu Akbar to be spoken the first time?
Well, they surrounded him and killed him, and they raped him and killed him.
Yeah, what happened? It was Muhammad's goons were headed back in shame with the bloodlust and mostly lust in their hearts. And in the morning, they came upon the town of Qabar. And it was a farming community. And the Jews in Qabar were coming out with their farm implements, hoes, shovels, rakes, you know, that kind of thing. And they were going to tend their fields, something Muslims did not do. Muslims did not harvest their own food. The only economy for the first Muslims was thievery.
They were from the caravans,
Yeah, it's like the mafia in the sense that the mafia doesn't engage in business. They rob other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's actually a pejorative. That's probably not true. You know, the mafia does sell drugs, and the mafia does run rackets. And but Muslims don't do any of that. Their economy was like Genghis Khan. So. The first Jews are coming out in the fields, and they said, oh, my God, here he is again. You know, he's the one that not only kicked us out of our hometown and robbed us, sent us out to the desert to die, but subsequently the next two groups of Jews, he became murderous, slicing off 900 men's heads in front of their families on one day, gloating while he was doing so, raping the women. While he was cutting off the men's head. And so Muhammad was a despicable scumbag of unimaginable proportions. I mean, imagine raping women while you're making their mothers and wives and children watch you cut off 900 men's head and throwing the bodies and the heads into a trench that you had dug right there in the center square as you all squealed and clapped and applauded. I mean, the perversion here that we witnessed in Paris with guys walking in and for a period of an hour and a half gunning down people who were unarmed, it doesn't even compare. Compared to Muhammad. So as these people saw, the farming Jews saw that Muhammad coming in his goons, they knew they were in serious trouble. And so Muhammad starts to taunt them. And the ultimate taunt for a Jew, for someone who is Torah observant, for someone who is aware of the Torah,
right,
is that Satan, Allah, is greater, bigger, and older than Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
That Satan came before Yahweh, that Satan is more powerful than Yahweh, that Satan is above Yahweh. So knowing the name of the God of the Yehudim, because you know he called them Yehudim. They were Yehudi and Yehudim. They were not Jews to him, and he knew that they were named after their God, who was Yahweh. So he had his goons shout, "Allah is greater. Allah is above your God." And as they shouted that to taunt the Yehudim, the Jews, Muhammad then led his raids. They killed
him. And while they raided.
Yeah, that's true.
Cowardly.
Yeah. He had every man killed, torturing the leaders, robbing them of all of their possessions. Muhammad then got first dibs on the women to rape. The whole story of the woman who was named also after Yahweh. Her rape is told in excruciating detail in the Hadith. And then they sold the children into slavery, and Muhammad's goons are credited with robbing the Yehudim. That is where Allahu Akbar was first stated. And from that moment on, Allahu Akbar would be shouted every time Muslims terrorize unarmed civilians.
To this day.
To this day. And God damn it, pisses me off, Kirk, that Muslims confess to the crime, 9/11, screaming Allahu Akbar, and the Paris massacre, screaming Allahu Akbar. Every time they create a terrorist assault, screaming Allahu Akbar, and everybody in politics and the media and the military all says, boy, we don't know why they did this. What was their motivation? God damn it.
Yeah.
They're telling you the motivation. They're confessing to the crime. It could not be more obvious. That's what Allahu Akbar means. And by the way, I'm not swearing when I say God damn it.
No, you're not. It's God separate. You know,
yeah. God. Yeah. He forsakes, he separates. He has nothing to do with Islam or those who coddle it. So Aaron Rodgers is at a football game. They have a moment of silence for the Parisians, and somebody has the good sense to say, you know, Islam is the problem. Islam sucks. Something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And old Aaron Rodgers says, you know, that's pejorative. That's disgusting. Now, what's disgusting is not holding Islam accountable.
I sent you an email about that yesterday.
Yeah.
I told you in the email I have absolutely no feeling of remorse or anything for Paris. Do I like that innocent people have gotten that were killed? No.
There's some sweet people that whose lives were cut short.
Exactly. And do I want to see
that? They were loved by family and all of that is a shame, but their leaders brought it on.
Well, over the
and they elected their leaders. So, for
the past year now, I've listened to you list off various news articles and things like that, talking about the situations in Paris. We had a few months back, we had the Charlie Hebdo thing.
Right.
At this point, if they haven't actually had the wherewithal to take a stance,
yes. Right. It is their own fault. It is their own fault, absolutely. Now, are the individuals who were killed collectively responsible for their own death? No. But collectively, did the French citizens do anything to shed their ignorance? Did they collectively say, you know, the problem is Islam, we've got to deal with Islam, and then demand that their public officials deal with it? No, they didn't. And so this is the consequence. Evil prevails when people don't have a backbone.
And then it also led to 9/11. It led to scary moments for me. Nationalism for me is one of the most absurd, craziest things. Like, I have Timber season tickets every time I don't step up, stand up every time they honor a veteran or something. Somebody will say something to me, and every time it's like, well, shut up. But with this thing, it's actually gone a step farther. It's gone from nationalism to globalism.
Yeah, it is.
And that's even scarier.
Oh, we stand united. We're going to rally around the French flag, the French colors, the fleur-de-lis. We're all Parisians. No, we're not.
And that scares me even more. Because somebody... It's the same reason I have a problem with nationalism. Somebody that's hundreds of thousands of miles away from me, you know, they have no idea what it is, what I need or what's good for me.
Correct.
You know, it's the old what's good for the gander isn't necessarily good for the goose.
That's correct. Now, I'd ask you a question, Scott. Or Kirk, after 9/11, we invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq.
Right.
How'd that work out for us?
Horribly. It worked out horribly.
The loss of $4 trillion and the death of a million people who claimed to be Christians that were wiped out, plus the millions of other people and that we destroyed. And
there's a connection between Libya and Muammar Gaddafi and the downing of the Pan Am 747 over Lockerbie, I don't know if it was England or Scotland, but in the British Isles. Subsequently, we bombed and flooded Libya with weapons. How'd that work out for us?
Well, ask the people at Boko Raton, what's the group in Africa that...
Boko Haram.
Boko Haram, and they destroyed all those little girls. Ask the little girls how they felt about the whole thing, because that's where they came from. They had to have a base. They had to have weapons.
Yeah. So I'd ask you another question. You know, today, the Russians announced that their airplane, killing 250 people, was brought down by an Islamic State bomb, and that they're going to seek vengeance and punish those responsible. How do you think that's going to work out for them?
Well, ultimately, it'll destroy Russia.
Yeah.
They'll get beaten up really bad.
At this point, can we just declare our the way we deal with the world as being insane?
Oh,
we're doing the same thing over and over, and we're expecting a different result.
Correct.
And it's never going to happen.
Right. So the President of the United States, after Paris, says, you know, we must destroy the Islamic State. Paris said that they're going to be merciless towards the Islamic State. Collectively, the world started increasing its bombing attacks on the Islamic State. How do you think that's going to work out for us?
I think there'd be terrorists all over Europe ready and planning their next attack.
Isn't one of the axioms of human understanding that those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it?
And they do.
You know, we don't even have to deal with history that goes beyond the length of our arm. I mean, we're dealing with events that have taken place over the past decade, and yet we can't even learn from an onslaught, an avalanche of absolute proof that everything that we have done in response to Islamic terrorism has been counterproductive, and yet we keep on doing it.
You can go in my lifetime. In my lifetime. You just take my lifetime, which is, you know, only, you know, five or 6 years younger than you guys, right? And but in our lifetimes, think of that. In the span of history, our lifetimes are minuscule, but 35 years, 35 years, that's how long I've been here. I can take the 35 years of my life, and I can see that the history's already there, and
of
it's
course.
Repeated itself numerous times.
Well, let's talk about proxy wars. The United States decided that we would arm the Taliban and create an organization called Al-Qaeda. We'd supply them with $5 billion worth of Russians for them to remove the socialist, albeit secular, government from Afghanistan. What was the result?
Taliban took over.
The Taliban, right. So how'd that work out for us?
It did, and it's still not. It's still ongoing.
Still ongoing. So we're now arming a jihadi Muslim, Sunnis, to take out the Assad regime. How do you think that's going to work out for us?
He's just going to arm some more enemies.
You know, we armed the jihadists to take out Muammar Gaddafi. How'd that work out for us?
Good move.
Let me ask you a question. I'm just going to ask a question. Uh-huh. When has it ever worked out that giving somebody weapons made something better? When has that ever worked out in history? Has there ever been a time?
No, you know, even in the Manifest Destiny, where the Europeans thought that the Indians, as opposed to themselves, were the savages, and they gave weapons to Indians to have Indian tribes go off and kill other Indian tribes, and those weapons were used against the settlers as well. You tell me, I don't think. So there's never been a case where it's turned out well. You know, we gave weapons to Saddam Hussein, and then we attacked Saddam Hussein and fought against our own weapons. We gave weapons to Iraq, and those weapons were seized by the Awakening Program graduates called the Islamic State, and now we're bombing them. We're providing weapons to the Kurds, and American weapons are bombing the Kurds. And these buffoons like the Abominator and Kerry and their ilk stand on their goddamn moral soapbox and lecture the world about evil. And we're the most murderous, most insane nation on earth.
Yeah, and as far as being promoters of terrorism, we have to be number one.
Oh,
we
God.
Have to be number one.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question. How did America's invasion of Vietnam work out for us?
Well, we gave them weapons too, you know.
Yeah.
Before the Russians came in, we gave them
weapons. Of course. Of course.
They had nothing. Yeah. They were like crossbows and, right. I mean, arrows and...
How'd that work out for us?
Yeah.
Exactly. What did we learn from it?
Not a darn thing.
Not a thing.
We don't get anything out of it.
No.
You know, when England conquered places, they took over some of this stuff.
You know, we decided that we were going...
But they had a motive, a private motive. We just kill ourselves with this stuff.
Remember during the time that there was a myth that America was at war with Al-Qaeda and not fundamentalist Islam? Remember that time? It wasn't all that long ago.
No.
Well, if you remember that time... Then you might remember the fact that in Yemen there was a alleged affiliate, and we decided that we would go to war against them. It was the Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, and we bombed them into submission. How has Yemen done since we did that?
Still in civil war.
Well, far worse. Kirk, it is astonishing that Muslims could cause 99% of the world's terrorist acts and not hide from it, you know, brag about it, celebrate it.
When they don't even do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one thing to get somebody to be vicious enough that you would... perpetrate the kind of carnage that we see Muslims doing. You know, bring down an airplane of 250 people. But they celebrate it.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's just great. They're all doing it in a service to their God. And with that occurring, it's stunning that the preponderance of people want to say it's not Islam. That it's a corruption of the religion. So if it's a corruption of the religion, then I'd have to ask you, yeah, why is it that this was the behavior of Muhammad? Why is it that this is the basis of the Quran?
Well, that's probably why they didn't want to keep it being called Mohammedans. They didn't want to be known as Mohammedans. They want to become known as Islamists.
Yeah, the ones that surrender, the ones who submit to the will of Allah, who was modeled after Satan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's... All you have to do is read the Quran and Hadith. And that's all you got to do. And you know the answer to this question. But even if you didn't read it, and you looked at where are the terrorists coming from, What religion are all of the terrorists? Who are they named after? What are they shouting? And yet, with overwhelming and undeniable, and I mean, we're not dealing here with a situation where you've got, well, it's, you know, 53% of the terrorist acts are perpetrated by these people, so, you know, it's really not fair to slather them all with one brush. Well, in this case, it is. It's 99%. And so it is appropriate. And in fact, to do anything else would be inappropriate. You know, there was yesterday there were seven U.S. states where the governors came out and says, you're not bringing any Syrian refugees into my state.
I heard it was increasing, yeah.
And as of this morning, it was up to, I think it was 27 governors have come out and said, yeah, you're not bringing any of those Syrian refugees into my state. And so this Christian theologian who was head of World Refugee Services or something says, that's absolutely perverted and preposterous to say that we shouldn't bring in these Syrians because there'll be terrorists among them. Well, isn't that just what happened in Paris? How could it be preposterous? You know that of the seven known perpetrators, that six of them were from Syria?
I thought it was less, but still.
Yeah, that's six. Now, there's two of them that subsequently took up residency, but the only one that really grew up in France, just one of them, and he was a regular at his local mosque, and so he got Islam the old-fashioned way. But the fact is that most of them were, in fact, from Syria.
Clue.
So how can this Christian come out and say, well, that's preposterous, when that is exactly the evidence? You just look at what's happening in Syria. Then the president of the United States says, you know, these people, we can't turn them away because these are the victims of terror. No? They're not the victims of terror. They're the perpetrators of terror. Islam is the perpetrator. It is.
We bring in people who have Ebola.
Of course.
I mean, we're stupid.
Yeah, but Scott, Kirk, what's deadlier, Ebola or Islam?
Islam.
Yeah, it's not. Well, of course, by far, maim more people, kill more people. I mean, the mutilation rate on Islam is a millionfold over Ebola. Mm-hmm. They're not even close. You know, I do want to spend some time on, because the majority of our audience they may be ignorant regarding Islam. The thing that and that would be a product of socialist secular humanism, they've been brainwashed by political correctness to reject exercising good judgment. So, there's a certain number of people that what we say will resonate with them, and if they're socialist, secular, humanist, and they hear somebody consistently explaining the world as it actually is, they may turn to what they have to say about it, who God actually is. But I want to address Christians.
Okay.
Is it possible, even remotely possible, to claim that, even if you knew his name, that Jesus Christ was the founder of the Christian religion?
He is not, no.
Yeah, and it's impossible, A, because there was no Jesus.
Jesus Christ.
The title Christ is completely bogus. For starters, yeah, and if you want to claim that somebody founded your religion and you haven't got a clue what his name was and you haven't got a clue what his title was, and you write it as Jesus Christ, as if Christ was his last name, then you have absolutely no understanding of who he is. If you don't know his name, I'll guarantee you don't know who he is. Now, beyond that, the Christian religion is based upon a New Testament, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And that New Testament is about salvation through the gospel of grace. Mm-hmm. And it says that we are no longer bound to the Torah, and that since the Torah could not save, because no one can be perfect, you needed this Jesus Christ to start this new religion where you could be saved by faith. Did he say that?
Yehoshua never said that.
No. No. And if the Torah is obsolete, why was Yehoshua Torah observant?
That would be a very good question.
If you're going to follow him, wouldn't you have to be Torah observant?
If you're going to follow him.
Yeah, if you're going to follow his example, he was wholly and completely Torah observant. How can you claim to be in a religion that's based on his life and not be Torah observant? It's asinine.
Yeah.
What about the fact that, you know, you have a religion that's based upon this alleged New Testament and a rejection of the Torah, and he says, do not think that I came to annul the Torah. And for those who would say, well, you know, you said the next line was, I came to fulfill it, and that means he did away with it. Wait a minute. Don't think I came to do away with the Torah. I came to fulfill it, and fulfill it means I came to do away with it. So I don't think I came to do away with the Torah. I came to do away with it. Is that what you really want to believe, Christian? I mean, think of the stupidity of that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the next line is not a single yod or tittle. The yod is the what?
Smallest letter.
Yep. By the way, the yod would also be the first letter in whose name?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Everything down, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Or tittle. And what are the tittles?
Strokes.
Yeah, the strokes of what? Of what?
Of a letter.
Of any alphabet in any language.
Hebrew. Of the Hebrew.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not a single stroke of any of the letters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet that compose the words that are found in the Torah will be annulled so long as the heavens and earth exist. Are you sitting down?
I am, and I'm looking out a window with the sun shining. So.
Okay, and your chair is firmly planted on the on the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you got a sun, you got an earth, you got a sky. Haven't been done away with yet, has it?
Not yet.
So how can you be in a religion? How can you uphold a religion that replaced the Old Testament with a New Testament when he said not a single letter of that Torah is going to be done away with until the heavens and earth no longer exist?
We got a real problem.
You got a real problem.
I learned that one.
Yep. I mean, it is so preposterous. I mean, every aspect of Christianity, that God died for your sins. Well, God died, huh? Why don't you tell me how God dies?
Well, tell me who killed him. Who could kill God?
Who can kill God? So you're going to tell me that man can kill God? That there was a period of time where God didn't exist? I mean, that would be what you'd have to say.
It would be illogical.
That God didn't... if you killed God on a Friday afternoon, and it wasn't until in your religion on Sunday morning that he reappeared, was the universe godless during that period of time?
Well, whose word was holding it together?
So you're going to say your God is small enough, puny enough, incompetent enough that man can kill him? I'm going to tell you the God I know. He is, essentially light. Can you kill light?
Hasn't been done.
No.
Can't be done.
No, it can't be done. In fact, Yahweh can't even kill light. That's why there's a prison for Hasatan and the Malach, the envoys, the spiritual envoys, who are working adversarially, because he has to lock them up forever in a black hole because he can't destroy light, can't kill light.
And that amazing concept.
Yeah.
Explains so much.
Right. You know, what's also interesting is that death is, should man have been able to kill God, and should there have been, the world been godless for this period of time. Can you explain to me how death is all of a sudden is the means to life? How is death the means to life?
You can shed your body, but you can't. If your soul dies, then your soul dies.
Yeah, as a matter of, by the way, you know, when God's talking about this, you know, if someone is dead, they just cease to exist.
Mm-hmm. It says it hundreds of times.
Oh, yeah, the soul ceases to exist. I mean, if you're really dead, your soul ceases to exist.
Right.
So I guess God couldn't have been dead, because his soul didn't cease to exist if he was resurrected, huh, Christian? Now, Christian, you know, explain this. Maybe you have an answer for this one. If God died, then why were his last words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why have you separated yourself from me? If God separated himself from the body on that pole, how did God die?
He would have to be terribly confused.
Wow. Yeah. So it was no longer God there. So the body that died wasn't God, because God separated himself from that body.
Right.
Well, your whole religion just falls apart with his statement on the upright pole.
There's a very point when the spirit attaches itself to that body. There's that soul. And a very point when it detaches.
Correct. Now, when if you're going to have this religion based upon a Sunday morning resurrection that you're going to call Easter, Ishtar was a Babylonian. She was the mother of God and the queen of heaven. So, yeah, those Christians that are Protestant that think, well, we're not into Mary worship, like those Orthodox or the Catholics are. Oh, yeah, you are. You go celebrate Easter. You're into Mary worship, because Ishtar, which Easter is named after, is the prototype for Mary being the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. So if that's going to be the basis of your religion, if your God, whom you killed and who now came back to life, well, who knows what he was doing during those 3 days, because he was dead, right? So he couldn't have existed. But he came back to life. And now he's going to make the fact that he is resurrected bodily is the basis of the proof statement of his new religion.
Mm-hmm.
Would he then be recognizable or unrecognizable?
If he came back in that new body, in that body, he mm-hmm. would be recognized by the people who knew him.
Otherwise, it would be an absolute worthless. Yeah, it's got no validity whatsoever if it's not recognizable.
Okay.
So there's four counts by the eyewitnesses, the disciples who had known him for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Of those who followed him, there are four counts that take place on that day and in the days that that follow. What is the common denominator between all four counts?
Nobody recognized this guy. They thought he was a gardener. They said,
you know, how could you be the only person that doesn't know what took place in Jerusalem? And he said, well, let me explain it to you by going through the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms of the two fellows on the road to Emmaus. He walks through the empty room. No one recognized him. He then shows up for breakfast with the disciples, and they'd already seen him once where they didn't recognize him. He shows up for breakfast, and they don't recognize him then. In other words, he bore no likeness to the body that he had previously occupied at all. Because what happened to that body?
According to Pesach, it has to be destroyed, the body, after
that
the nourishing part, and the rest of it should be burned up.
That is correct.
Therefore, that body had to be destroyed.
That is correct.
The nourishing part.
Yeah, and he had a Bikurim body.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to a Bikurim body. Because with a Bikurim body, you are in the world of E equals MC squared. What does that mean?
Well, that means you can be both in light and you can be diminished into matter.
That's correct. You can transition between energy and matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did. That's just the bottom line here, folks. In fact, on the Mount of Transfiguration, he actually did a variation of that, too. The transition between energy and matter, E equals MC squared. Einstein explained it.
Yeah.
Yosha demonstrated it a couple of thousand years before Einstein came upon the theory. But that's that is exactly what occurred. Oh, by the way, was there a Last Supper?
Well, there was a meal, the Passover meal, but...
Was it called the Passover meal by Yosha, or was it called the Last Supper by him?
I wanted to enjoy this Passover meal with you.
Yes, exactly. And so he called it a Passover meal. You know that the King James, they suppose it authorized, inerrant word of God. You know in the first three versions what they called that meal?
Probably the Last Supper.
Easter.
What do they call it?
Easter. Oh, no, they call it Easter.
Easter.
They call it Easter.
That would make sense in King
James. Oh, God. He celebrated Passover, and he became the Passover lamb. In fact, don't all the prophecies speak of him being the Passover lamb?
That's the Lamb of God.
Yeah. So don't you have to read the Torah to understand the function of the Passover lamb, what it represents?
What source would you go to? How many times did Yosha say, go to the Torah?
Yeah. Exactly. And if you don't know what happened the following day on the Shabbat, on Saturday, what is what follows Passover? That is that has a Shabbaton. It's a special Shabbat.
Special, yeah. It's the matzah.
Right.
And they call it. It's so important. They call it the whole week matzah.
Right. That's right. Unyeasted bread. We're gonna remove all traces of the fungus of sin from your soul, so that you are perfect in God's eyes. And that's dealing with the separation of the yeast from the bread. So it explains what happened on that day. And then what's the day after matzah?
Bukurim.
Firstborn child. Firstborn children, actually, because it's YM from Bakar. Firstborn child, the plural of that, Bakurim. Firstborn children. So who was the firstborn child?
Yosha.
You betcha. And he simply manifest, his soul was released from Sheol, and he was the set apart spirit came back upon him, and the very spirit of God that made him a diminished manifestation of Yahweh came back upon him, and he was now a E equals MC squared construct.
Mm-hmm.
And it all makes perfect sense. It perfectly plays out exactly as the Torah outlined it. And as a matter of fact, what is the last indication of something Yosha promised and talked about that would have been essential? In fact, Yosha says, I'm going to have to leave prior to this because the way this is going to be manifest, you're going to see the counselor. Is going to manifest this on your behalf. But so seven sevens,
mm-hmm,
after Bukurim,
Shabuah, right?
Shabuah occurred. And on Shabuah, was the church born?
No.
No, it wasn't.
Church. There is no church. There's no church promise. There's no talk of a church, and it certainly wouldn't be called church if it... In any context.
Oh, but didn't Yosha say to Shimon Kefesh, the person that they've corrupted to Peter, didn't say, upon this rock I'll build my church? How could you say there's no church?
No, I think he was talking about his mikra.
Oh, that's what he said. He wasn't speaking English. He wasn't speaking Greek. The Greek doesn't say church. In fact, it says, it translates what he actually said, because he was speaking what language, Kirk?
He was speaking Hebrew.
Right. And in Hebrew, he said, upon this rock, all means upon, so all. Rock is sur, so upon this rock, he uses sur all the time to speak of the rock of our salvation, that is rock of our tzedakah. That is presented all the way through the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So, upon all sur, this rock, I will establish. You know what the Hebrew word is for establish? We talked about it yesterday.
Quam.
Well, that is one. Kru means to stand up, and it can be translated as have, is a good guess. And karat likewise can be translated. And is there a possibility that he could have used kum or karat because he could have, karat would have been and kum both in association with the Torah's possibility. But you know, the primary Hebrew word for establish in the sense of I will build, I will rebuild, I will establish, I will reestablish, and specifically building a home. It's the feminine of the Hebrew word for son. Bena.
Huh?
Bena. Doesn't actually mean daughter, but it's Bena means to build a home. So Bana, actually, it's pronounced Bana, but it's written the same way that you'd write Bena. Bena and Bana are written exactly the same way in Hebrew. Bena means daughter, and Bana means I will build, as in a family home, but written the same way. The first letter is the Beth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which defines what the word means.
Right, family home.
Family home. The second letter is absolutely indicative of who that home is home is for, isn't it? It's the nun, the inn.
The inheritance of the children who inherit.
Right, yeah. Depicted as a sperm, the child with an inheritance who enters the family home. And the way that you get into the family home, and the way that Yahweh enabled us to enter the family home, is depicted in the next character, the hay. The person standing up, isn't it? Yahusha stood up for us so that we could inherit his family, his covenant. And it also means that those who come into Yahweh's home so on their feet. Yeah, they're walking away from human institutions, and they're walking into Yahweh's family. So that's Al for a pawn, and Al, by the way, also means Almighty. So Al, Almighty, followed by Sur to build. By the way, Sur is an interesting word too because it begins with the TS. Signpost, right? Signpost on the way?
Yeah.
So this rock is the place where the signpost and along the way can be found. The next letter is the Wa.
Wa, which is the increasing of the family home.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And so then the next, of course, is the observant individual. Yep. Scott has informed me that we didn't hear the music and needs us to wrap up so that he can.
I was skipping commercials again, so
go to the top of the hour break.
But okay.
Wave. That's.